A number of years ago, I started using the Fourth Amendment domino analogy to explain how Fourth Amendment decisions have to be made correctly and in the correct order. I've been talking about these Fourth Amendment dominoes and using this analogy for years now. In today's case of the week, you're going to see another example of the Fourth Amendment dominoes in action.
Bringing you the latest case law updates on the legal aspects of law enforcement. This is Broadcast Blue.
Welcome to this edition of Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinar. I'm your host, Bruce Allen Barnard. This week I'm coming to you from Eastport, Maine. Each week I bring you a legal update by way of my case of the week, and this week's case of the week I've called the case of the frisky bullet. If you're new to Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday, there's three different ways that you can watch or participate in the case of the week. You can watch the webinar and attend the webinar live, and there's information about how to do that on my website at broadcast.blue. You can also download the podcast available on iTunes and Google Play. Broadcast Blue is the name of the podcast. And we have our own Broadcast Blue Vimeo channel, and you can find information about that on the website broadcast.blue as well. So if you're new, welcome, and regardless of the medium, you're going to get the same information. Special shouts this week, a special shout to the folks at the National Park Service in Tupelo, Mississippi, graciously hosted me for a four-hour legal refresher and update last week. Had a blast conducting that training for those folks out there. Some great food in Tupelo, Mississippi, if you've never been there, and I ate a little bit more than I should have, to be honest. And also a shout to the folks at the Tupelo, Mississippi Police Department. A few of those folks attended as well, and I look forward to coming out there and providing some live training to the folks at the Tupelo, Mississippi Police Department as well. Okay, let's dive into the case. This is the 12th edition this year of the case of the week, and this case of the week is United States versus Johnson. This is the second episode in a row that we've had from the 11th Circuit. I don't know that we've ever done that before. Typically switch it around, but we had the 11th Circuit last week, and now we have another 11th Circuit case. And this case is dated the 22nd of March, 2018. Again, United States versus Johnson. Let's take a look at the facts. This case originated in the Southern District of Florida, and specifically in the town of Opa-locka, Florida. If you're not familiar with Southern Florida, Opa-locka is north of Miami and just east of Miami Lakes. And did some training down in Miami Lakes for the folks at Health and Human Services, and great group of people down there. Driven through Opa-locka many a time. Population is about 15,000. Unfortunately, Opa-locka is a high crime area in that part of Florida. And on June 14th, 2015, a little after 4 o'clock in the morning, it's still dark outside, the Opa-locka Police Department received a 911 call about a potential burglary in progress at a multifamily duplex. Now, this duplex was located on Superior Street. And if you're watching the video or participating in the webinar, you actually see what the unit itself on the screen at this particular point. Multifamily duplex there in Opa-locka on Superior Street. The duplex had 4 units. Now, the 911 caller reported that a person was trying to get through the window of a neighbor's house and described the person as a black male wearing a white shirt. And officers were dispatched to the scene within 5 minutes of receiving the call. 2 officers arrived at the duplex in separate cars at about the same time, and one of the officers spotted the defendant in this case coming from the back side of the duplex on the west side through an unlit alleyway. The west side of the duplex would be the left-hand side as you are looking at it from the front. The defendant, a black male, was wearing a white shirt, and the officers did not see anyone else in the vicinity. At this point, the officers drew down on the defendant, in this case, Mr. Johnson, ordered him to come to the front of the building with his hands up, and he complied. He was handcuffed, ordered to get down on the ground, and He was obviously at that point detained. After he was detained, the officers conducted a pat-down search for what they described as officer safety. And when one of the officers was conducting this pat-down, he felt something in the front right pocket. He immediately recognized one thing that he felt as a round of ammunition, and he also felt something else that felt like a nylon piece of material. He reached his hand into the pocket, took out what turned out to be a nylon holster, a pistol holster, and one round of .38 caliber ammunition. At that point, the officers asked Mr. Johnson, is there any more weapons or anything near that this ammunition or holster goes to? In other words, they're looking for a firearm. And Mr. Johnson said there was not. Now, you got to think about it. At this point, the officers have detained someone who they suspect of burglary. They've conducted a frisk and they've found an empty holster and a round of ammunition. And so they're thinking there's a firearm somewhere, that he must have ditched the firearm somewhere. So after they find this holster and this round of ammunition, they start looking around. And when they look around, they're canvassing the area, looking around in the area, and they come across a wooden fence in the back of the unit. Now, at this fence at the back of the unit, there's a hole in the fence. And upon being asked, Mr. Johnson stated that he lived in the unit that was behind the one that they were currently at. In other words, on the other side of the fence. And if you're watching the video or if you're joining me live, you see at this point the fence, the actual fence. This is a look of the back of the property where he was detained, where he was suspected of breaking in. This is actually the fence from his side, from where the hole went. And this is relevant and important because they went around. And remember, it's been about 15 or 20 minutes since he's first been detained, considerable amount of time since he's been frisked. And so they've been looking for a firearm. They're convinced there's a gun somewhere. And sure enough, when they walk around, they go to the other side of the fence where the hole is, where he says he lives, they find firearms. Specifically, they found two handguns that were lying near the hole in the fence. At that point, one of the officers ran a check on the serial numbers and discovered the firearms had been reported stolen. At this point, Mr. Johnson was transported to the Opelika police station. Obviously, he's under arrest. He read his Miranda, he was provided Miranda warnings. The court says he was read his Miranda rights in question. You know, I hate that. A little bit of a side note here. Say that he was given his Miranda rights, or he was warned. He was given Miranda warnings. Miranda doesn't give you any rights that you don't already have under the Fifth Amendment. It's just a reminder of what those rights are. And the courts are really fond of calling it Miranda rights instead of Miranda warnings, but that's just a little pet peeve of mine. So it's my podcast and I'm throwing it in there. So he's transported down to Opelika police station. He's Mirandized. He's questioned, and he claims that his brother and his cousin bought the firearms off the street, brought them to his house, and the three of them hid the firearms in the backyard. Well, lo and behold, Mr. Johnson is a convicted felon, and so he ends up getting charged. In October of 2015, a grand jury returns an indictment charging him with felon in possession of a firearm and ammunition in violation of 922G of Title 18. Well, you know what's going to happen here. The defense attorney's going to use the defense F word. That's fair. And say, hey, this isn't fair. This is a violation of the Fourth Amendment. Specifically, the defense makes two arguments that there are two separate Fourth Amendment violations. Now, it's important to note that the defense conceded that the Terry stop itself, the initial detention, was valid. But the defense argued that the Terry frisk was not lawful, that there was no warrant or consent, and that there's no judicially recognized exception that applied, and therefore the Terry frisk itself was unlawful. The defense also argued that beyond the initial frisk, extending the Terry frisk to a search of the pocket, to sticking the hand in the pocket, and the seizure of the holster and the bullet was unlawful. They argued that all the evidence should be suppressed. That includes the firearms that were found as a result of finding the holster and the bullet. Remember, they would have never looked the way that they did, and by their own admission, the officers and their testimony in the court below stated that they would have never initiated that search but for the fact they found the holster and the bullet. They're trying to figure out, hey, look, you know, where there's a bullet in a holster, there's a gun somewhere. And they were looking for that. And also his confession, because when they got him down to the station and he's talking about how they bought the guns off the street and buried them in the backyard, he's acknowledging that he was in possession at one point in time. And that's important for that constructive possession, because they didn't find them in his hands, right? So it's going to be a constructive possession case instead of an actual possession case. And his acknowledgement of the fact that he's the one who placed the guns there along with the two relatives is going to be tantamount to a confession of his possession of those firearms for which he was charged under 922G. And so the court, the defense attorneys want to suppress that as fruit of the poisonous tree as well. The district court denied the motions to suppress, and therefore we have an appeal, and that's the purpose of this appeal to the 11th Circuit. So there are two issues on appeal to the 11th Circuit. The first is, was the pat-down frisk lawful? And the second issue is, was the continued search when the officer reached into the pocket, continued that Terry frisk by reaching into the pocket, was that continued search and the seizure that came after that, the retrieval of the holster and the ammunition, lawful under the Fourth Amendment? Okay, so the first issue is going to relate to the actual Terry frisk, because remember, even the defendant conceded that the actual Terry stop, the detention that took place initially when they first came across him, was justified. And just as a quick refresher, Terry versus Ohio gave us two very important JREs, two very important judicially recognized exceptions. And sometimes it gets a little confusing because they tend to meld together. Sometimes even the courts tend to meld them together. But they're two distinct JREs, and there are two separate tests. In order to be able to do a valid Terry stop, you have to articulate facts that create a reasonable suspicion that a person is involved in criminal activity. That's a very straightforward test, and it's a very important JRE, and we use it very often. The Terry frisk, and they both came from the same case, so they have the same name, and they even use the same level of suspicion, that reasonable suspicion. But they're different tests. The Terry frisk is a reasonable suspicion that a person is presently armed and dangerous. Well, in the beginning of its analysis here, the 11th Circuit starts addressing the concept of the Terry stop, saying that, and to determine the legality of the stop, they have to consider if the stop was justified at its inception, and they cited cases for that proposition. But it's already been conceded that the Terry stop itself was lawful. And just by a quick little point out here, you don't have to have a Terry stop in order to have a Terry frisk. Typically, you have to have someone who's been lawfully detained, but there are other methods of detaining people that could lead to a Terry frisk. For example, if you're executing a warrant, you might be detaining someone that is located on the premises while you're executing the search warrant under the Michigan v. Summers doctrine, and have us what we call a Summers detention that could lead to a Terry frisk. Well, that's not a Terry stop. That's a Summers detention, and it's a different type of JRE. It's a seizure, to be sure, and so since it's warrantless, in order for it to be reasonable, there has to be a judicially recognized exception, and there is, and it's called a Summers detention. So not all detentions are Terry stops, and not all Terry frisk come about as a result of a Terry stop. And I just wanted to point that out because the court in this particular case spends a lot of time talking about the stop and talking about the things that led to the stop and what it was that made the Terry stop itself reasonable. But it's not until you get to page 15 where they start talking about the actual crime that they suspected him of in the second paragraph on page 15. They finally get to the main point here. It says, the district court found that Officer Williams and the other officers were responding to a reported burglary around 4 a.m. in a high-crime area. And they stated, in which many burglaries involve weapons. So they're dancing around the fringe of it, but they're not quite getting to it, which is a little disheartening. It doesn't have to be a high crime area for someone who is suspected of burglary to present a reasonable suspicion they're presently armed and dangerous, and that's because burglars use tools. What about a screwdriver? What about some type of putty knife or something that someone could use to jimmy a window open? It could be used as a weapon. So even if it wasn't a high crime area, every once in a while, there's separate tests. And so you have to go through the Terry test separately. Just because you get a Terry stop doesn't necessarily mean you get a Terry frisk. You might have a situation to where you reasonably suspect someone is driving drunk. You can articulate facts. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. They're weaving within their lane, but not touching the fog line or the center line. And they're doing 35 and a 50. You put all these facts together, make you think that this person is driving impaired. What are you going to do? You're going to do a Terry stop. But do you have facts to support a Terry frisk of that individual? And the answer is no. You don't always have those facts. You don't automatically get a Terry frisk with a Terry stop. There's no automatic. But sometimes, as in the case of Terry itself, remember in Terry versus Ohio, Detective McFadden suspected that these three individuals, Terry, Chilton, and Katz, were casing either a jewelry store or the United Airlines office to rob it. Well, when you rob something, it's typically an armed robbery. And so robbery is something that goes hand in hand with firearms or something that can be used as a weapon. So if you suspect someone of armed robbery, if you suspect someone, the courts have said, of grand theft auto, if you suspect someone of an armed assault, if you suspect someone of burglary, then the facts that give you the reasonable suspicion that they're involved in criminal activity will also typically suffice in the second test as well. It's not the fact that this was a high crime area so much as it is the fact that burglars use tools. When people break into buildings, they typically use a tool, and those tools can be used as weapons. And they kind of tap danced around it. They finally got to it, but not directly. It's a little bit disheartening. And the test is whether a person who's been lawfully detained is presently armed and dangerous, a reasonable suspicion. Can you articulate the facts to give you a reasonable suspicion that someone is presently armed and dangerous? Now, of course, for those of you in the Fourth Circuit, we have the Robinson case came out last year, and cert was denied by the Supreme Court in October of 2017, where the Fourth Circuit stated that if armed, therefore dangerous. Someone is armed. If someone is stopped, you conduct a traffic stop and they're armed, they are dangerous de facto. Just the fact that they're armed during a traffic stop is going to mean that they're dangerous. But that's a Fourth Circuit rule. And so unless you're in the Fourth Circuit, I certainly wouldn't hang my hat on that one. Stick to the test. Stick to tried and true. What you were taught when you went through your various academies or law enforcement training, or if you're an attorney, hopefully you learned either through your research or in law school. And the test is whether a person who's been lawfully detained is presently armed and dangerous. And when you have someone who is suspected of burglary, you are going to typically meet the test in that case. And the court in this case, although not directly getting into it, the 11th Circuit determined that the Terry frisk, the initial frisk, the pat-down frisk of Mr. Johnson was lawful under the Fourth Amendment. But remember, the defense attorney's having two bites of the apple here. He's got to show that one of the dominoes is bad, and he's made arguments that two dominoes are bad, but all he's got to do is win one of the two. And so after the court determines that the initial pat-down frisk was lawful under the rule of law in Terry versus Ohio, we now have to go on to the point to where the officer actually reached into the pocket and took out the bullet. When he patted down the pocket, he immediately recognized that piece of ammunition, that ammunition as a bullet, a round of ammunition in this person's pocket, along with something he described as nylon material. And when he immediately recognized that as a bullet, a round of ammunition, he reached into the pocket and he pulled out a holster and this round of ammunition. Well, having an empty holster leads to a whole new inquiry now. You know, where's the gun? And they start looking for the gun at this point that would normally go in a holster. Now, remember, the whole purpose of the Terry frisk is to allow the officers to do a pat-down, a limited type of search. The court's going to grant this judicially recognized exception to allow a limited type of warrantless search under the rule, under the test, that this person is presently armed and dangerous, that reasonable suspicion that they're presently armed and dangerous. But it's going to be limited. It's very limited in scope. It's going to be limited to looking for a weapon, something that can be used as a weapon, like a screwdriver, something, a hard object that can be used as a weapon against the police officer. And the officer stated as soon as he felt the pocket, he felt a round of ammunition, and he felt that holster. Now, the rule of law in the Terry frisk allows this Terry search to continue, go beyond the frisk into a more concentrated search of an area where the officer feels something that he reasonably believes could be a weapon. So during the pat down, if there's an object that is concealed that the officer feels that he reasonably believes could be a weapon, then that, under the rule of law in Terry, it allows the officer to go into that particular area, in this case a pocket, and pull out the object to identify it, to ensure that it's not something that can be used as a weapon, and if it is, to remove it from the person, at least temporarily, while they're being detained. So the court properly noted that the pat down and feeling of an object in a pocket is limited to determining if the object is a weapon. What if it's not a weapon? There's another judicially recognized exception, which is an extension of the plain view seizure doctrine, and it is called the plain touch seizure doctrine. And I've talked about it before. The blue key case for that is Minnesota versus Dickerson, which is a Supreme Court decision that was issued in 1993. But basically, the plain touch seizure doctrine is an extension of the plain view seizure. It's just using a different sense. Instead of using the sense of sight, it's using the sense of touch. So in order for something to be seized under the plain touch doctrine, it has to be immediately apparent that the object is contraband. So plain view seizures and plain touch seizures under the Minnesota v. Dickerson judicially recognized exception allow for an officer to go into a pocket when they're doing a pat-down frisk, and while they're doing the frisk, they feel something that, as a result of their experience and their training, is immediately recognizable to them without manipulation to be contraband. And this is typically seen in drug cases where someone's doing a Terry frisk and then they pat down a pocket and they immediately recognize the shape and the feel of the drugs in the pocket during the pat-down frisk. So now the question is, do either one of these judicially recognized exceptions apply in this scenario? When he felt the ammunition in Mr. Johnson's pocket, it was immediately recognized to him as ammunition. But ammunition all by itself is not a weapon. Mr. Johnson couldn't take a bullet out of his pocket in his hand and use it as a weapon against the officer. It has to be in a firearm in order for it to be effective as a weapon. And so even though he immediately knew it was ammunition, he didn't know, he didn't have any reason to believe that it was a weapon. And at the point in time that he felt that what was immediately apparent to him was a bullet, he did not know that Mr. Johnson was a convicted felon. So that would not even give him the probable cause to arrest him at that point if he immediately recognized it as a a round of ammunition, and the fact that he's a convicted felon, if he knew it at the time, then he would have that probable cause at that point, and things would have happened just a little bit differently. But that he didn't know at that point. And so there was nothing, it wasn't contraband, it wasn't evidence of criminal activity that he knew at the point in time that he conducted the frisk. And it's not certainly not a weapon, a round of ammunition all by itself. And so the court ruled that neither Terry nor Dickerson justified the warrantless retrieval of items that were found during the pat-down. Together, Terry and Dickerson allow an intrusion into the pocket if an outer clothing search allows a police officer to conclude that an item in a pocket is either a weapon under Terry or contraband under Dickerson. If the item that is immediately felt in the pocket is not in these two categories, then it cannot be retrieved under one of these two judicially recognized exceptions. And without a JRE, a warrantless search is unreasonable under the Fourth Amendment. As a result, the 11th Circuit held that the district court erred in not suppressing the ammunition round and the holster, and therefore reversed the district court's decision not to suppress the ammunition and holster, and they vacated the judgment entered against and the sentence imposed on the defendant in this case. It was remanded for proceedings that were consistent with the opinion. So what's going to happen now? It's going to go back to the district court, where the defense will undoubtedly argue for the exclusionary rule to be applied. And the government will undoubtedly argue for the inevitable discovery doctrine to save it. And based on the fact once he'd been identified as a convicted felon, I mean, that he was detained, and so they would have identified him and eventually ostensibly discovered he was convicted felon. At that point, the fact while he was conducting the Terry frisk, he immediately recognized ammunition in the pocket. And had he not gone in to retrieve it, once he knew the person was a convicted felon, that would have given him arguably the probable cause to arrest for being a felon in possession of ammunition at that point. So make an argument for inevitable discovery. Who knows? We'll have to see where it shakes out. We'll have to stay tuned and see what happens. This is a great example of what can happen if you forget about the requirements for these different JREs, these different judicially recognized exceptions that we typically rely upon in our Fourth Amendment dominoes analysis, lining these dominoes up. You don't just have to do the right thing. You have to do the right thing for the right reason. You have to have the correct action for the correct reason and make sure you're lining up your Fourth Amendment dominoes properly. Well, that's it for our case of the week, and that concludes this edition of Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinar. Thank you so much for joining me here on Broadcast Blue. Check out www.broadcast.blue for more information regarding upcoming webinars, information on how to subscribe to the podcast. You can listen to the podcast directly from the website itself, or you can subscribe to the podcast, which is even better with iTunes or Google Play. Also, you can check out the recordings of the webinars and watch. If you listen to the podcast and you want to actually see the slides and see that what other people are seeing if they attend the webinar live, you can do that. You can link on www.broadcast.blue, or you can go straight to www.brownbag.video on our Vimeo channel. Dial it up on your Roku. If you get the Vimeo plugin on your Roku and watch the videos and at your leisure. Thank you so much for joining me. Thank you so much for what you do. I challenge everyone listening or watching to take just a few minutes to email a few of your colleagues and let them know about Broadcast Blue and what we've got for them here. And join me again next week. I'll be back in Florida next week, and I'll have another edition of Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinar then. See you then, folks.